This episode of the podcast is brought to you by my friends at Zoandez, the world's leader in brine field services. Check them out at Zoandez.com. That's Zoandez.com. Hi, it's Joe Lowry. Welcome to another episode of the Global Lithium Podcast. Today is episode 181. My guest is Seth Goldstein from Morningstar. Seth is an equity strategist and chair of Morningstar's electric vehicle committee. He knows what's going on in the lithium world. He follows it closely. And I always enjoy talking to him. Seth is the analyst for five lithium companies: Albemarle, SQM, Arcadium, Lithium Americas, and Lithium Argentina. Serendipitously, we scheduled this episode to be recorded the day after Lithium Americas received conditional approval of a $2.26 billion loan for Thacker Pass, and we get into that. First, I'd like to say congratulations to Lithium Americas. It is not a trivial event to get through all the hoops that you have to get through to get approved for a loan of that size. And thanks to Jigar Shah and his team at the Loan Programs Office, although many of us felt this was slow in coming, it has come, and I appreciate the fact that the Loan Programs Office has seen fit to provide the financing for a critical project like Thacker Pass. Without further ado, Seth Goldstein. Seth Goldstein, welcome back to the Global Lithium Podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Joe.
Because you've been on multiple times, I will not ask you to go through your backstory yet again, but I would like you to just remind the listener of what your role is at Morningstar.
So I'm an equity research analyst. I cover chemicals, which includes lithium, agriculture, and traditional specialty chemicals like a DuPont. I also chair our electric vehicle committee, through which I cover Tesla, where we forecast one global EV forecast that all analysts, including myself, can use to implement into our models so that we're hopefully forecasting a consistent valuation throughout the entire EV supply chain.
I watched a short interview you did with CNBC a while ago, and you were pretty much right on. It was at the time I bought Tesla again, like 109. And, you know, your prediction on Tesla proved to be prescient. Congratulations on getting that right, because a lot of people don't. The last time you were on, Lithium Americas was one of your top picks. You talked about the split. I love the way you looked at that 2 years ago. Now the split has happened. Lithium Argentina is in your last work as one of your two top picks, along with Albemarle. But Lithium Americas remains a five-star. They didn't get top billing, but they were close. Yesterday, Lithium Americas was given conditional approval on a $2.26 billion loan for Thacker Pass. How do you view that? And how do you view its importance?
Yeah. So, Joe, if I can start with defining top pick, because I think that would provide some helpful nuance as to, you know, distinguishing Lithium Argentina and Albemarle from the other three lithium companies I cover: Lithium Americas, Arcadium, and SQM. In general, I view all five lithium producers that I cover as materially undervalued due to my bullish outlook for EV adoption and bullish outlook for where lithium prices are going over the rest of the decade. That means that if you are investing in any of the five producers I cover, I view them as undervalued and good long-term investments. But I'm often asked by clients, you know, what is your top one or two lithium picks? And so I try to create a cost and risk framework to look at The lithium stocks independent of prices, because right now, pretty much every lithium company I cover is in five-star territory, which is our most undervalued rating, which means we view all lithium companies as very undervalued and good long-term investments. But I also try to analyze costs and risks to look at what has the lowest company-specific risk and is most likely to be the best way to benefit from rising lithium prices if my forecast comes true. So all that being said, when I look at Lithium Americas, I'm very bullish on the company. They're in five stars. We have an $18 fair value estimate. A part of why I'm bullish on the company is the long-term value I see in the Thacker Pass resource. I forecast 240,000 tons as the sort of long-term steady state volume capacity. That's way beyond phase one and phase two. And as a part of that, I was pretty confident that they would be able to qualify for the DOE loan, which then triggers the tranche two of the General Motors equity financing, which basically covers phase one CapEx nearly fully, unless there's some major cost overrun. So with that being a catalyst for the stock, we've seen the shares run up yesterday, continue their run up today. And now I think we'll see Lithium Americas, the market perhaps get a little more bullish because this potential negative catalyst of being rejected by the DOE loan is out of the way. And now, I think we'll start to see sentiment for Lithium Americas turn closer to the broader lithium price and what they do.
Well, you have disarmed one of my questions, because later on I was going to talk to you about the fact that your top picks are all selling for less than half of what you believe fair value is. And I tend to agree with you, and we can get into a little bit more detail on that. Given that you do follow these lithium companies and you follow LAC, obviously. So when you were trying to ascertain timing of the loan, you know what a rigorous process the loan office puts people through, because they don't want embarrassments that had happened in the last go around during the Obama administration. They are very careful. If you look specifically at the DOE criteria,
Well, I reviewed the ATVM criteria to make sure that this would qualify. For example, the mine portion I do not believe qualifies for the loan. So when the DOE was sizing it, they were looking at what is the non-mining portion in order to make sure that they size what would qualify. So that was something I took under consideration. My goal was to figure out, one, will they qualify? And two, if they qualify, can they get a loan that's large enough combined with the GM equity investments to fully fund phase one? Or are they likely to have to go pursue outside financing through the debt or equity markets? And from my analysis, it seemed likely to me that they would qualify for the loan and that would be enough to fully fund the project with the GM investment.
well, we've heard a lot of comparisons and criticisms that, hey, this is the capital intensity is so high. Why is that? And when you look at vertically integrated hard rock or brine, and you look at the capital intensity for 40,000 tons, it is higher. How do you put that into a perspective of the fact that it's also going to be America's first significant lithium asset to come online in decades? How do you view it?
Well, I think it will create long-term shareholder value. And so I think that the US government wants to incentivize an EV supply chain. And doing so doesn't just mean, giving credits to the end buyers of EVs or even just battery manufacturing credits to build battery factories here in the US. They want to really incentivize the entire build-out of a full EV supply chain, which includes the mining or the processing of lithium. And so I think that that is a very positive for opening up a new mine, as long as it's agreed to be done in an environmentally responsible way, which so far it seems that Lithium Americas has a very responsible mining program that they've signed up for.
Yeah, I think the mining part of this, when you compare it with hard rock, is greener for sure. We won't go too far down that road. Because I do intend to talk to John Evans in next week and have him on. Coming back to Lithium Argentina, too. I think Black, when it was both companies' stock, hit 40, and Cauchari was still in doubt, and the loan was very much in doubt. Now, if you take the two companies today, they might add up to $11 or maybe 12 if I haven't looked at the stocks in a few hours. Cauchari's ramping up. From my perspective, ramping up faster than I would have expected, especially when you compare it to what happened in Jujuy with Orocobre. They have more volume, quicker, and better quality. So, how long do you think it takes the market to realize that there's a lot more value here than they're currently getting credit for?
Well, Lithium Argentina is interesting because you have a management team that does not like to make a lot of flashy announcements. They prefer to execute and tell you that they've executed. They initially targeted 5,000 tons of production in 2023. They hit 6,000 tons, exited 2023 at a 50% capacity run rate, which is very impressive for a new brine project. We rarely tend to see that occur. Even your majors like Albemarle and SQM, when they initially went to expand production years ago now, they had some initial troubles in ramping up volume. So, I think it's very impressive to see producing at a faster than expected capacity at a higher run rate. But here's I think a management team and with a strong partner in Ganfeng that wants to make sure they can actually deliver what they're going to put out there. So they've refrained from potentially throwing out long-term numbers for Cauchari or putting together some, maybe long-term numbers that don't have a lot of details around them behind the Pastos Grandes project. And so in absence of those long-term forecasts, I think the market may be struggling to understand the long-term volumes and therefore the long-term value that they can produce as a company. But I tend to take a look at them and I see two high-quality resources. I see a management team and a strong partnership with Ganfeng that is focused on execution. And so I think that they're the most undervalued lithium producer based on my view that Cauchari will see multiple capacity expansions after phase one and that Pastos Grandes will be successfully entering production by the end of the decade.
Fair enough. I tend to agree with you. And I was texting them. I knew they had made multiple shipments. I said, when are you gonna tell people that you're actually shipping? And that is obviously very much counter to some other companies that announce the same shipment multiple times in different ways. Albemarle, certainly the largest lithium company in the world, by the way I view it anyway. That's one of your top picks. How would you summarize where they are now?
At a big picture, Albemarle produces lithium from three of the best resources in the world, as measured by the quality of the product they're producing, whether it's brine or hard rock, and the longevity of those resources and the cost they can achieve when they're fully ramping up production. So, in my view, while Albemarle certainly has some perhaps strategic changes that we see depending on where we're at in the price cycle, and there's been some surprise announcements, such as the equity raise that I didn't think was absolutely needed, but management chose to do so anyway. That they've also had a pricing strategy change in recent years. So they have three great resources, but they seem to be struggling to come up with a consistent strategy for their lithium business. And I think that results in a little extra volatility in the share price. That being said, if you are looking to invest in one lithium producer, I tend to prefer existing producers because there's always risk if you're ramping up a new project and don't yet have any revenue or profits that you're generating. And Albemarle's low-cost resources will allow them to benefit greatly from what I see as a coming lithium price rise.
Well, the interesting thing about Albemarle, largest lithium producer in the world, yet their price in 2023, when the narrative was that the sky is falling and prices are down by 80%, China spot price anyway, Albemarle's price in 2023 was higher than 2022. And I don't think they're the only ones in that boat. How did you view that? Did you view that as Maybe they got the contracts wrong last time. Maybe they've improved the contracts. Did you see that in a positive light from changing past mistakes, or did you still, I mean, I'll just leave it open to you. How did you view that?
Yeah, I was certainly critical of Albemarle's former pricing strategy, and you saw it in the lithium price run up in from 2020 until late 2022. SQM had by far very rapidly rising prices and profits. We did not see the same thing for Albemarle, and that was due to these long-term fixed price contracts that they were in. I do prefer lithium producers in general sell at market-based pricing because I don't think it's going to be easy or really achievable to beat the market from a pricing standpoint over a multi-year period. You might get lucky for a year or two if you have a fixed price contract, but if you remember in the last downturn in 2018, 2019, and 2020, Albemarle's customers came back to them and demanded they cut their fixed prices, and Albemarle gave in and did so. So, if you want to have less price volatility because you're trying to generate free cash flow to fund lithium growth projects, I can understand that, but the contracts need to hold as intended if you're going to set floor prices. So if the contracts don't hold the floor and then you're also not getting the upside, then you're just kind of losing out to market-based pricing on, both the way down and the way up. And I just prefer that, this new index pricing, I hope it matches more market-based pricing. It seems like that's the direction they're moving in. But I also want to take a wait and see approach here because last time their floors were supposed to hold and they didn't. So I want to see what their prices and profits actually look like as we move through a cycle with this new pricing scheme.
Well, and that was really the intent of the question, because they have maintained over the last 5 to 7 years at different times that their pricing strategy was one thing, but when it was tested by the market, it didn't seem to hold. And now they have a X percent is contracted, X percent is spot. How do you view the veracity of those numbers? And I'm not going on a witch hunt against Albemarle. I'm just A lot of times when people say X percent of our contracts, all those contracts have volume variability in them. How do you come to the conclusion of what percentage of your contracts are priced in a particular way? Am I asking a fair question there, or is that overkill?
I think it's very fair to ask any lithium producer that's not disclosing their prices and volumes or allow you to easily calculate their price like SQM does. It's fair to ask what's your prices? What's your pricing scheme? How does it work when prices rise? How does it work when prices fall? And to hold them accountable to what their answers are. So with Albemarle, they've chose to do this. I think now it's two-thirds are these index reference price that have a midpoint, supposedly have a cap and a floor on them. And that Albemarle has said with these contracts, if prices rise $10, they should rise five. And prices fall $10, they should fall 10 or five, excuse me. And then the rest is spot, which is going to be in China. So it would be maybe a 3 month lag to the current China spot price, if I understand it right. And so that's fine if they want to do that. We'll just see how it actually works. I want to see, are their margins expanding? Are profits rising accordingly to how they should, based on what they've said is their pricing scheme.
Well, you also follow Arcadium and SQM. What's your 2 to 3 minute commentary on each of those companies? I've been a long-term SQM holder. I'm very interested in your thoughts on that.
We can start with SQM. So SQM, I think it has a good long-term lithium growth strategy, but also in 2030, based on their new agreement with Codelco, 50% of their Chilean plus one share, 50% plus one share goes to Codelco, to the Chilean government. And so as a result, you're going to see a much smaller economic share. Now, that being said, under this new agreement, their lease gets extended to 2060. And as I understand it, they get to expand production from about 200,000 tons a year to 300,000 tons a year. So they did get that in return. So they're not losing 100,000 tons. They'll lose somewhere around 50,000 tons based on the current capacity. But they will have to divest that portion. And so for growth, they're expanding into Australia. They've brought on their new Covalent Lithium JV. They brought that on. Now they're going to acquire a second asset that's in an early stage of development, which I think makes a lot of sense if they're confident they can develop a project to get in as early as possible. Take the partnership route, which might help them with having a local joint venture partner that might help them remove regulatory hurdles and that sort of thing, have a favorable public image for government announcements. So I think they have a good long-term growth strategy, but we'll see if they can expand to 300,000 tons by 2030 or where they're at once that 50% divestiture kicks in.
SQM, lowest cost brine producer, X royalty. Hard Rock is more expensive generically than their brine asset. And they've also been doing the same thing now in the Atacama for their third decade, I guess, maybe fourth, depending on how you want to count it. How do you view their transferability of skill set to Hard Rock, which is a much different animal? And especially with Wesfarmers, because Wesfarmers had no lithium experience. When you look at that as an analyst, does that give you pause, or do you think that their deep pockets win the day anyway?
I think that they can figure it out. I think that they will be able to hire the engineering team to eventually make the battery quality chemicals and figure out the processing. I think the upstream mining part is going to be the new challenge. But if you're looking at producing spodumene versus converting spodumene, I view the conversion into an acceptable battery quality product as the harder part of the two, which I think they would most likely be able to, maybe at least transfer the final processing know-how, when they're upgrading to either the battery quality carbonate or hydroxide that they sell, based from the Atacama. So I think they'll be able to figure it out. That being said, when I see a company investing into a new line of lithium production where they're not already experts, I tend to think they might face some delays because they're trying to figure it out. It doesn't mean that they'll never get there, but I tend to model a year, 2 year lag versus what management says in my own forecast, just to try to account for the sort of ramping up and learning curve once they start trying to produce the chemicals.
With the most specialized team of lithium brine professionals in the world, Zalandis is dedicated to providing exceptional customer service and support throughout every stage of lithium brine field development and production. From the Atacama to Hombre Muerto to the USA and Canada, go to Zalandis.com for more information. That's Zalandez.com. Let's spend a minute on Arcadium.
So Arcadium, very undervalued stock, but here I always highlight execution risk because you look at the two companies that made up Arcadium and both historically have not been able to grow volumes. And just for some context here, if we looked 5 years ago, so take 2018 volumes and where'd you grow to 2023, combined Orocobre and Livent grew 10% volumes. From 2018 to 2023, Albemarle grew about 2 times, SQM grew 3.8 times. And so you historically have two companies who have made a lot of announcements, planned a lot of growth, spending a lot of money to achieve that growth, and so far, very little to show for it. So that execution risk, independent of stock price, gives me a little pause to highlight that company because if they're unable to grow as much as they've signed up for, that might hurt the stock even as lithium prices rally. So, that's something I always like to look for is have you been able to successfully grow volumes, deliver projects, not on time because generally nobody's on time, but at least show some progress over a multi-year period towards meeting the long-term capacity growth. And here, execution risk just seems to be a big issue for the company. Now, perhaps you can say the two companies have complementary skill sets that could eventually lead to collaboration, and maybe they help fix some of each other's former issues, if I were to take the optimistic view. But if I'm gonna say that the execution risk days are behind them, I'm gonna need to see a lot of volumes coming online in the next couple years, without these delays. And when they announced the fourth quarter earnings, we heard another delay too. So we'll wait and see how it goes.
If I had been asked that same question, my answer would have been almost the same, just because that they do have great assets, but they haven't seemingly been able to unlock them. I think gives everyone pause. But if you were to rank their portfolio of assets, where would you put that among the top five players, just on an asset basis?
On an asset basis, I probably have to put them up there, with Albemarle and SQM as having very high quality resources. They have two very high quality brine resources that, if engineered properly, I think Olaroz is a high quality resource. If they engineered it properly, I think it could produce a lot of volume of high quality product. And you have, Salar de Hombre Muerto, I guess they're calling it Phoenix now. And that's another high quality resource too. So I think they have very good assets. Sal de Vida from the technical studies appears to be a third high quality resource. They have a project at Cauchari that appears to be another high quality resource. So they have a lot of really good brine assets in Argentina, but having the resource is one thing. Being able to consistently produce and execute on your projects is another thing. And they have the former, the latter is to be determined.
Do you view them as an attractive candidate for a big mining company or an energy company?
Potentially, if a mining company comes in and says, or even a major oil company who, Joe, I listened to your interview with Exxon, and they seem to think that the lithium brine is, not the hardest thing they've ever done. So if any company has the engineering expertise, I'd imagine Arcadium is an attractive asset to consider acquiring, because you can fix the engineering, bring in your own team potentially, and ramp up the volumes, and then have multiple very low cost resources to produce lithium.
Well, let's now move into the demand side here. And lithium has become an industry virtually totally dependent on where the battery market goes. EVs are by far at this point the biggest part of the battery market. We're coming off a year of 30% growth, plus or minus, depending on whose numbers you use, but it's significant. What are your expectations for EVs going forward?
I think we're going to see EVs continue to grow in all major markets, which for autos, your three major markets are China, Europe, and the US. But EVs are even growing outside of those markets too. And there's going to be different growth rates. And we tend to look at our cost and function framework to see, is there a multiple affordable vehicle models that are selling in all auto segments that are comparable prices to internal combustion engines? And then are you selling long range vehicles, which we define as at least 300 miles? And then does that country or region have enough fast charging infrastructure to where drivers don't have road trip anxiety? In China, we can say yes, EVs are selling long range models in all auto segments, and they've built out fast chargers every 50 kilometers along all major highways and throughout the major cities. Europe is getting there, but we're seeing a little bit of lag. But I think as we see more affordable vehicles hit the market, we're going to see a faster pace of EV adoption. And as Europe hits or builds the Trans-European Charging Network, which is going to be fast chargers every 60 kilometers along that major highway system. That should alleviate the road trip anxiety. The US, a laggard to Europe, I think the US will start to get there with the charging network and the affordable models later in the decade, maybe 27, 28, but be there by the end of the decade. And then we'll start to see a faster rate of EV adoption. But I think China was had such a fast rate of adoption that if you're comparing the US or Europe's growth to historically what China did when they had subsidies, it's going to look like the US and Europe are faltering and maybe EVs aren't catching on. But if you look at the actual growth numbers, we're seeing double-digit growth, 50% growth in the US last year. I forecast another 20 to 25% EV growth in all the major markets this year. So I think the EV adoption story is very much still intact.
The U.S. media seems to have gone very negative, though, on EVs, and you see it on the morning news shows. There does seem to be a political element to it in an election year, but ironically, I heard Donald Trump on CNBC about a week ago say that he'd be comfortable letting BYD build a factory here. He just wouldn't be comfortable with them building a factory in Mexico and then trying to import the cars because he wanted jobs. Again, it was Donald Trump, so I don't know if he'll be saying the same thing next month, but it was a very interesting turnabout because normally people think that if Trump gets elected again, that's the death knell for EVs. I've never really believed that because red states have more to gain with battery plants and where they're going and car plants. But how do you view the politicization of just the narrative for 2024? Because it's an election year, but it does seem to me that Ford and GM haven't really covered themselves in glory with their EV models. But I am shocked that the numbers don't seem consistent with the negative narrative on EVs, because as you say, growth was pretty good last year and it will continue to rise. How do you view that disconnect?
I think EVs are getting caught a little bit in the sort of polarization that we've seen when it comes to political topics in the US. And I think you're seeing the perhaps small voices on each side, whether you're very pro-environmentalist and think that EVs are the key to fighting climate change, or whether you would never buy an EV in your life, no matter if they're cheaper, because you just happen to like a good loud engine and want a traditional car. But I generally tend to think that the majority of consumers buy a car based on practical reasons. Even if you're in the market for a luxury car and willing to spend more, you're still going to look at, will the car fit my lifestyle? Does it have everything I need? And I think the ability to charge at home enough to stop at a gas station, whether you're, just driving to work every day and back, I think that appeals to a lot of people. And if the price is there, then I think a lot of people will strongly start to consider an electric vehicle. And if there's enough chargers built along highways, then when Norway and China completed their fast charging network, we've seen mass consumer adoption in the following years that happened. And I think the same will happen in Europe and the US eventually. So I don't think most consumers tend to buy vehicles based on political lines, but at the same time, I do think that the media tends to report based on the extreme views. And then you look at the US automakers where they've been pulling back EV investments. And a lot of that I view is because they haven't found out a way to make EVs profitable at a price point that can compete with someone like Tesla, who has figured out a way to do so. That's the reason I view we've seen a pullback in investments. However, it's easy to say, well, they pulled back investments because consumers don't want it. Consumers don't want a car for $20,000 more than a comparable Tesla model. And I don't think that's going to be, or a car that has, 75% of the range only goes 200 miles. I think consumers want the 300 miles. That's a psychological safety point when consumers are considering if the range is long enough. And when we look at these based on the practical cost and function, sort of metrics, I think if there's an automaker that can offer an affordable vehicle that's at least 300 miles and the charging network's built out, then we'll see a much faster pace of EV adoption.
BYD in the fourth quarter of last year eclipsed Tesla as the leading EV maker. Elon used to make fun of BYD pretty much every chance he got. Now he's playing catch up. Do you think Tesla regains the lead? Do you think that even matters? Because there's plenty of room for both companies to run. How do you view the battle for EV leadership?
I've always kind of viewed Tesla and BYD as what is their percent of market share in the total auto market. I don't think it matters if Tesla's number one in just pure EVs because that market's going to be growing so fast that they will likely lose market share over time. I don't think they're going to be able to catch BYD because if we had to look at Tesla's strategy, they prioritize the Cybertruck over this new affordable vehicle, and let's call it the Model 2. I don't think it has an official name yet, but and BYD has prioritized investing in the more affordable vehicle segment, which, if you're selling cars around most of the world, that's what consumers are going to want. And that's how BYD was able to pass Tesla in China, where Tesla is still selling very well in its more luxury vehicle segments, and the Model 3 and the Model Y are still very popular and growing in popularity among consumers. But the Model 3 and Model Y are also entry-level luxury vehicles, so you price out a lot of your consumers with that level of vehicle. Once Tesla launches the Model 2, they aim to launch it in 2026. If they're successful with that date, I think that will be a popular selling vehicle over time when they ramp up production. But by that point, BYD is going to be expanding into new markets. They're going to be ramping up their Dolphin and other more affordable model vehicles. And I don't think that it's going to be necessarily easy for Tesla to surpass them, but I don't think Tesla needs to surpass them either because the bigger goal is to continue to grow market share among the global auto market, which includes, all vehicles, not just EVs.
When I look at it, I think BYD and Tesla are both going to do fine. But when I see BYD now buying ships to transport their EVs around the globe, and I look at the legacy automakers and the fact that they're still okay now because they can still sell enough ICEs to make money. But do you see a structural change coming in the auto industry? As maybe some of the legacy automakers can't make the jump to electrification. How do you view the long term from the perspective of BYD actually started off with ICE vehicles, but they quickly saw the future and it was EVs. And so I would just view them as an EV company that doesn't need to sell ICEs anymore. Yet, when you look at our old big three and some of the big names in Europe, how do you see that playing out? How do you see the structure of the industry potentially changing over the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, I think Tesla and BYD will continue to gain market share in the global auto market. And I think that's going to put pressure on the legacy automakers to more quickly offer competing vehicles. And so the automakers that can and can credibly offer a long-range, affordable vehicle at a comparable price will be able to transition their portfolios. But the slower that they are moving on this venture, the larger the risk they have that, eventually the market for internal combustion engines starts to dry up in more and more geographies. And if you're not selling a competing or yeah, a vehicle, an EV that can compete with a BYD and a Tesla, then you're going to get very few consumers who are willing to buy it. We're even starting to see that a little bit in the US when you look at just EV sales. You're seeing Tesla through the first 2 months of 2024, Tesla sales have grown. Many of the legacy automakers who are offering lower range EVs and no longer qualify for the subsidy are seeing EV sales decline. And I think that's a preview of what could come if they don't start to transition their portfolios in a rapid manner.
Lithium prices have been on a wild ride. We've talked about on many of my podcast episodes, we've talked about what happened in 2022, and we had a large correction. How do you view lithium price now? Do you think it's, well, first of all, there isn't one lithium price is the way I like to characterize it. So when we look at Albemarle, largest lithium company in the world with higher prices last year, clearly there's something wrong in the narrative. But what are your thoughts on what caused the price drop last year? The supply chain seemed to be stuffed, and there's a balance in my mind between just cleaning out cathode and cell inventories and the impact that had versus what lepidolite and ore from Africa had. When you look at it, what are your thoughts, and what are your thoughts on what's a sustainable lithium price going forward?
Yeah, so I think that this was that the price correction, and I'm just going to look at realized producer prices. Let's take SQM because they're the easiest to figure out what they're selling for. They pretty much sell always on short-term contracts, so they are a good representation of what you could reasonably expect a lithium producer to sell at the short-term prices. SQM saw lower prices in 2023. And I think a lot of that was due to inventory destocking. If we look at CATL's financial statements, you can calculate their days of finished goods battery inventory fell to 40 days in the middle when they reported their half year financial results. Historically, CATL's held about 100 days of battery inventory. And so falling to 40 means they're not going to be producing as many batteries, which means they're not going to be buying as much lithium. And they're kind of just running their plants at a less than replacement rate while working down their inventory. I'd imagine CATL is not alone here and they're not trying to lose market share. And so what happens on their financials probably apply to many battery makers, especially in China, where you're seeing inventory destocking. And when we see periods of inventory destocking within the chemicals industry, generally, you're seeing the chemicals customers buying chemicals at a lower rate than the end market demand is. So we're seeing EVs continue to grow, but the battery makers aren't buying lithium in the volumes that is reflective of that end market growth. But you can't destock inventory forever. And so if the reason why we've seen the price fall was due to inventory destocking, which I view as the bigger driver. Once this ends, then we should see the price start to snap back in a fairly short order. Then we look at the supply side. And yes, we have seen new supply. We've seen DSO even creep its way back into the market, which tells you that there is a rush to process lithium and make chemicals. We've seen new higher cost spodumene coming from Africa. We've seen lepidolite, which I view as very low quality and setting the marginal cost of production. And that did help. The new supply did help to balance the market. But I view this as more of an inventory destocking event rather than a wave of supply that will lead us to massive oversupply for years and years to come. And when we look at the cost curve, I tend to think the minimum price should be set by the marginal cost of production. And when I look at lepidolite producers, I estimate the marginal cost of production to be about $20,000 a ton. And so with prices below $20,000 a ton, we've seen supply start to shut down. Now it's not going to be instantaneous and producers are still going to run, but we are starting to see on a year-over-year basis. We're not seeing the same 50, 100% growth rate that we saw towards the end of 2023. We're seeing maybe 5, 10% growth, and month-over-month production in China, lepidolite is starting to fall. And that tells me that the producers are not running in an unprofitable manner forever. They don't want to do so. And, you know, with prices below 20,000, I would imagine we don't see the lepidolite growth that we saw in 2023 continue in 2024 until we see prices well above 20,000 again.
So would you view the lower grade lepidolite, because there is a range in lepidolite between the artisanal and the vertically integrated. But when you look out at some of the forecasts that show $10,000 a ton of lithium and 400,000 tons of lepidolite, to me that's a complete disconnect. Because in order to have 400,000 tons of lepidolite supply, you're going to have a price probably at 30, because you're going to have some new capital invested. Does that thought make sense to you, or do you view it a different way? The trouble I have with the people that are saying lithium prices got more to fall, it'll go to 10,000, but when you look at their supply at 10,000 a ton, a lot of that supply is not going to get financed. And the lepidolite's going to be losing substantial cash. Does that hang with your analysis of this?
Yeah, I tend to look, if I'm looking to forecast prices, I'm trying to understand if we're below the marginal cost of production, what's the supply response? And we've seen lepidolite production slow. We've seen all the major lithium producers slow their supply growth. And you know, that tends to be classic bottom of the cycle response from the supply side of slowing your growth. And you know, we're seeing lithium where demand is still growing at a double-digit pace. So these swings between market being slightly oversupplied or slightly undersupplied, we're not talking about a lot of tons here. And we're talking about still a very rapidly growing market. So even just a small tweak lower to supply growth can easily swing the market back into undersupply due to lower prices. You know, we've seen Albemarle slash their CapEx budget. SQM's even slowed their production growth this year. We're seeing a lot of discipline from the supply side and deferment of new projects. And I think that sets us up for prices to rally. You know, I view a price falling to 10,000 as unsustainably low. Perhaps it could go there very briefly, but if we're saying prices are going to go to 10,000 and stay there for quarters or even years, I view that as highly unlikely.
This episode is also brought to you by Mississippi Lime, your innovation partner for solutions related to lime and calcium in your critical mineral processes. Visit lime4lithium.com. That's LIME, the number 4, LITHIUM.com.
Unless the EV demand story were to fall apart and no one wants to buy EVs anymore, which I don't think is the case.
If I read your report correctly, your feeling is that price averages around $25 a kilo between now and 2030, with some years higher, some years lower. Is that perceiving a market in relative balance and then just where the cost curve demands price be to continue to add volumes? Is that a fair assessment of how that works for you?
Yeah, I try to forecast a supply-demand balance each year. And in years where I see the supply deficit growing, prices should rise as buyers of lithium will need to pay up to secure their volumes. And in years when we see the supply-demand balance move closer to balance, prices might fall more towards a traditional cost curve, like pricing scheme. And so when I'm forecasting, I tend to point to my average of $25,000 as the most important key takeaway, but I also like to show an honest forecast of showing volatile prices because I think lithium prices will remain volatile for the foreseeable future because demand is growing very rapidly and we have this, you know, supply response where some years a lot of supply may come online and we might see some inventory destocking among producers. And other years, we might see producers running their battery plants at all full capacity, needing to buy as much lithium as possible, with less supply coming online, which will materially shift the supply-demand balance. I don't think it's ever going to be perfectly in balance, but no resource really is ever a perfect balance between supply and demand. So I would expect lithium to remain very volatile over time. But generally, I think we're going to see an undersupply for most of this decade. So I don't think prices will be at the marginal cost. I think they'll be slightly higher. And so with a marginal cost of 20, I get to an average of 25.
Last year, Albemarle started the year predicting 2030 at 3.3 million tons. They increased it to 3.7, and they've dropped it back down to 3.3. I think you're at 2.5 in 2030. Where are the differences in your two numbers?
Well, first, I don't assume that the average battery size will grow because I think that will the availability of lithium will be a limiting constraint on future battery and EV production plans, and automakers will have to adjust. And your vehicles of your big EV trucks that have a 200 kilowatt hour battery, probably not going to be the norm. So I'm forecasting that the average battery size stays at 50 kilowatt hours. I think Albemarle is going up to 60 or 70 by 2030. That's a lot of the difference. I also do forecast a little bit of sodium ion, particularly in the ESS market in China. I think that we will see some of that because I think sodium, when weight is not an issue, when energy density is not an issue, but cost is the only thing that a potential solar and battery project developer cares about, then they might consider a sodium battery. So I forecast a slightly lower ESS growth rate for lithium than I think Albemarle might. But that is the bulk of how I get to 2.5 versus Albemarle's 3.3.
Rho Motion has ESS at roughly 200 gigawatt hours this year. I think it's 196 is the precise number. Do you agree with that? Do you see that kind of growth coming in ESS, especially at current lithium prices, which makes it harder to justify sodium ion? What are your thoughts on ESS going forward?
I think ESS is going to be the one of the strongest sources of lithium demand growth. While I do think sodium will see some share in China, outside of China, I think it's going to be still mostly lithium batteries. And as we're looking to transition renewable generation capacity above roughly 30 to 40%, you need to start adding batteries, and certainly above 50%, you need batteries with every new project to ensure grid reliability. And now, the battery can also improve the solar economics by reducing basically wasted energy that you generate from a project that you can't sell into the grid because there's already enough energy in the grid. You can build a battery to store that energy and then sell it at a different time. This improves the economics. Battery costs are low to the point now where it makes economic sense to build the batteries with new solar and wind capacity. And so I think that this is a very strong long-term outlook for lithium demand for the battery market, in addition to what we see in the auto market.
What question that you'd like to talk about, that you'd like to answer, did I not ask you?
I guess we didn't talk about Tesla and Elon Musk owning X or Twitter, whichever you want to call it, if he's distracted by
I still call it Twitter.
that.
Well, that is a good point. As you view Tesla, as somebody that follows Tesla, I'm not sure there's ever been a company that's been as dependent on one guy as Tesla. Because you could make that argument with Apple, but I don't think that hangs because Apple's done really well post Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs was gone for a while. But if you're assessing risk on Tesla, and if Elon gets hit by a beer truck tomorrow, what's Tesla's future look like?
Well, I think here it's important to separate the underlying business from the stock, because if Elon Musk steps down for whatever reason, from CEO of Tesla, you're probably going to see the stock sell off. That being said, I think Tom Zhu, who's effectively Tesla's chief operating officer, could step into the CEO role. I think he'd do a fantastic job. And I think Tesla showcased at its investor day last year a strong leadership team where I don't think that they would necessarily start missing milestones. I would still expect the development of the affordable vehicle. I would expect the focus on reducing unit production costs to drive profit growth, even without having to raise prices. And so I think Tesla, as the underlying business, would be just fine. But it would take a while for the market to perhaps come around to the fact that Tesla can still grow without Elon Musk in the CEO role.
So Tesla has their own Tim Cook. That's basically what you're saying. Apple's done pretty well in the last decade.
I think there's less key man risk than perhaps there used to be at Tesla.
Okay. Thank you very much. Rapid fire. What is the last book you read that wasn't a kid's book?
I read a book called The Price of Time that looked at the effect of different interest rates throughout historical periods and the according stock valuation. So it was very interesting. You go through different periods throughout the various European countries when they issued higher or lower interest rates. There was a particular example I found where supposedly England, there were a lot of companies for plans to build railroad tracks all over England when there was a zero interest rate environment. A lot of those never materialized. The companies went bankrupt, but it was just an interesting to see, how we've seen different stock markets value companies or ideas based on where interest rates are.
If you had to move outside of the United States to live, where would you go?
My wife and I did live in Paris for a few weeks one time. And that was really cool to live in that city. I don't speak French, so I'd have to work on that before considering living there full time. So I think I'd go with Cape Town in South Africa. I had the fortunate ability to be able to go there last year to speak at a Morningstar conference down there. And this city's the one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in the world. You have the oceans, you have beautiful mountains, you have vineyards, all within a 5-minute drive of each other. And so I think that would be a cool place to live.
Your daughter turned 4 days ago. What's she watching now? What are you watching with her?
We are in a big Disney phase right now. So Moana and Encanto and Frozen are pretty much on repeat, either the music or the movies in some form.
Do you find yourself with the lyrics in your head just because you've heard it so often? I used to have that problem. I used to just be, I'd be, why am I thinking of this? But
Every day, every day.
thank you so much for your time, Seth. I know the audience appreciates you and your work, and we appreciate you as a guest on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Joe.
Another episode is in the books. I always enjoy Seth's calm, measured analysis. I appreciate the fact that Morningstar gives him the freedom to be his own guy and come to his own conclusions, and the fact that he is willing to give honest opinions about what he sees in the marketplace. At the end of the last podcast, I mentioned the death of my sister. I got a lot of nice condolence messages, which I deeply appreciated. So, anyone that reached out to me, thanks. It meant a lot. And thanks again for listening.